hoax. It must be pretty exciting to write a TV pilot that is getting produced. But according to the new movie comedy, The TV Set, it can be pretty awful, too. Every step of the way, there's another compromise to make if you want the network executives to greenlight your series. My guest, Jake Kasdan, wrote and directed The TV Set. It stars David Duchovny as a writer whose TV pilot is being cast and produced. He intends it to be a dramedy about a young man who is, among other things, dealing with his brother's suicide. Here he is talking with several network executives, including the president of the network, who's played by Sigourney Weaver.
Should we talk about the script?
Yeah.
There's a feeling among some of us. Is it absolutely necessary that the brother commit suicide?
Sorry?
It's just so sad.
Yeah, I never saw this as a suicide show. I see it more like a guy comes home, the town needs him kind of show. A little northern exposure, a little Ed.
You see, it's very personal to me because my brother killed himself. That's where all this came from. And, you know, the suicide, to me, has always been kind of the premise for everything that happens.
I know, but let's just think about it for a second. What if it weren't?
Jake Kasdan knows about what can go wrong during the piloting process. He directed the pilots for Freaks and Geeks and Undeclared, as well as a pilot that was never broadcast. Kasdan grew up around movie sets. His father, Lawrence Kasdan, directed The Big Chill and Silverado. In Jake Kasdan's new movie, two actors audition for the leading role in the pilot. The more subtle actor, the writer's favorite, bombs. The one that is over the top wins the enthusiastic approval of the network executives. I asked Kasdan if he had a similar experience.
I've always, in fairness, ended up with somebody that I wanted, at least the vast majority of the time. But there is something about the way that they cast pilots that makes it difficult for a certain kind of acting and a certain kind of actor to be cast. And part of that, and what we sort of illustrate in the movie in detail, is that before a lead actor is cast in a television pilot, they have to audition for a room of like 25 executives. And the kind of acting that plays in a room like that, essentially a small, very cold theater, is different from the kind of acting that plays best, you know, when a camera is 6 inches from your face. So the person who does the bigger thing will often play better to the room. And I've had that happen before, where someone comes in and is kind of more obvious with jokes or the delivery of their line, and it, you know, plays to the back of the room, as they say, and they get the part where the quieter, subtler performance might not.
When you were auditioning actors for Freaks and Geeks, and you did the pilot of that in several episodes, so I'm assuming maybe incorrectly that you were in on the auditions.
Yeah, I was.
Were there executives who wanted, like, actors who looked, like, super geeky? Like, too much? You know, like, who wanted, like, Napoleon Dynamite as opposed to an actor who would look like they would be the kind of high school kid who would be really self-conscious and uncomfortable, but not, like, crazily geeky?
There was a little bit of that. To be fair, Freaks and Geeks was a uniquely great creative experience, and we really were able to do pretty much exactly what we wanted without a lot of resistance. I think mostly because no one at the network believed that the show had a chance. And so there was some attitude that it probably wouldn't be around that long. So they would sort of let us do what we wanted. And at the pilot stage in particular, there was, I feel like what really happened is there was a sort of a corporate shakeup right before that pilot season at NBC. And there was sort of no one doing the job that Sigourney's character in the movie is doing, the network president who sort of has the controlling aesthetic. There was a little less of that kind of conversation at the pilot stage, at the casting stage, and the result is we got pretty much exactly the cast we wanted on the show and made a pilot that people really seemed to respond to, but that was generally perceived to have very little chance commercially. And so that combination of having of being sort of loved by critics and perceived to be doomed in, as a standing series somehow created a combination where they would sort of let us do what we wanted with the constant looming threat of cancellation.
Now, what I find really sad about this is Freaks and Geeks was really a terrific show, but it did get canceled. It never became popular, although it's developed quite a cult following from the broadcast and from the DVD release. But it never really did well on TV, and it didn't last long because of that. So, like, God, you know, maybe those network executives are right, you know, that you have. If you do think that's something that's, like, more subtle and more funny in a sophisticated way, that it's not going to work.
It won't reach the audience that, you know, the thing about making a television show for network television is that you have to reach such an enormous audience in order to justify staying on their air, you know, from a business point of view. So we were drawing, I think, 7 or 8 million people a week and were the lowest rated show on network television, really like number 99 or something on the Nielsen ratings. You know, they talk about it like there's just no one watching, but there were 8 million people and we were getting destroyed by cops every week. I mean, like, not even close. My favorite one was there was one day where the ratings came back and we were in fourth place, and there had been a rain delay in a baseball game on Fox during the playoffs, and they had put on a rerun of America's Funniest Home Videos that had crushed us. And in the ratings, it said Freaks and Geeks had been blown out of the water by, it said on the ratings sheet, America's Funniest Rain Delay. So we were... couldn't compete with America's Funniest Rain Delay.
You know, there's a lot of, like, corporate network speak on the part of some of the executives in the movie. My favorite line is the Sigourney Weaver character, who's the president of the network, says about one of the actresses being auditioned, "She doesn't let her cuteness get in the way of her hotness." Can you talk about writing that line, or did you actually overhear somebody say that?
I don't know if I've ever heard exactly that phrase, but it's the kind of thing that people talk about and debate with incredible seriousness in auditions. That's sort of embarrassing on the drive home. And also, it's the kind of conversation that as a writer or, you know, director, you can become involved in and find yourself debating their cuteness versus their hotness. See, I do feel like her cuteness gets in the way of her hotness. You can sort of get co-opted into the conversation a little bit more than you expect to. And, you know, which is also part of what the movie's about, is when the landscape is that way, and when they've just made a lot more shows than you have, you know, a lot more. They're dealing with a lot more pilots at any moment than you are. And they just have a lot more experience, and especially, like, I was, you know, Freaks and Geeks was my first TV experience, and then I did some other stuff after that, but there is a part of you that always thinks, like, well, maybe they know something about this that I don't know, and there was a danger that her, you know, cuteness could get in the way of her hotness. So you hear that kind of thing a lot.
My guest is Jake Kasdan, director of the new film, The TV Set. Here's a scene from the pilot of Freaks and Geeks, which was directed by Kasdan. The series is about a group of kids in a Michigan high school and centers around a geeky freshman named Sam and his older sister, Lindsay, a smart girl who's friends with the kids in the Freak or Burnout clique. Sam is goofing around with his friends doing Bill Murray imitations when a bigger kid comes over and tries to rough him up until his sister intervenes.
Sam Weir. You really like Bill Murray, don't you?
Yeah, he's great.
Bill Murray, man.
No, he doesn't. He's cool.
Oh, really? What is he? Your boyfriend? Sam Queer? It's fighting time, Weird.
Leave me alone, Al.
I'm sorry. I don't speak geek. I always wanted to know what it'd be like to fight a girl.
I'm a girl. Want to see what it'd be like to fight me?
Weird's sister has to protect him.
I'm not protecting him. Just trying to figure out why it is you need to pick fights with guys who weigh less than 100 pounds.
Watch out, Alan. I think she's high on pot.
Yeah, I might just go psycho on you. Want to try me?
You're dead, all right? As soon as your freak sister isn't around, I'm gonna cream you, man.
You know, you really didn't need to do that. I could have handled it.
Yeah, I know.
And by the way, I weigh 103 pounds.
Sorry. Man, I hate high school.
So how often did you hear when you were making pilots, or how often did your friends who made pilots hear, it's too depressing, that part of the story, so we have to change it?
All the time. I mean, it might be that I'm just drawn to material that people find depressing, but, I mean, that was the running conversation, certainly on Freaks and Geeks. The language that they would use a lot of the time is, you know, can't they have more victories? Can't these geeks have more victories? We want them to win. We want to see them win. Why can't they just once get the girl? And our thing, and Paul Feig, who, you know, it was his baby in a way, felt very strongly and was absolutely right that, no, not even once. It ceases to be the show that it is if the geeky little guy gets the cheerleader. And eventually we had heard it so many times that in that specific case, the goofy little geek kid getting the cheerleader, we eventually came up with a really Paul eventually came up with a really funny sort of morbid way for him to get the cheerleader, which is that he finally, after the whole season, kind of gets her attention for a minute, and they're dating as much as, you know, freshmen in high school can be dating, and, you know, people who can't drive. And he immediately realizes that she doesn't get any of the jokes, and he doesn't really like her that much, and ends up breaking up with her in the next episode. So it was sort of exactly the opposite of what the network had been requesting the whole time, which is that there could be a moment where our kids are happy. That's really what they're talking about is, you know, when they say victories, is like something we can celebrate at home. There's a little victory. They made it across the, you know, they made it into the end zone in some way or another. And, you know, what we always heard and what they in fact meant is this is depressing. And there was stuff like that on Undeclared throughout, certainly on the Zero Effect pilot. That was sort of a running issue there, too. Yeah, I'm always hearing that things are too depressing.
Well, you know, you're talking about the pilots of Freaks and Geeks. There is a kind of semi-victory moment, like one of the geeky kids asked the taller, really pretty girl to dance at the prom. And she
accepts. He gets his one dance. That's right.
Well, no, but the thing is, you know, it's like a slow dance. And he takes her, takes this long walk with her across the far end of the dance floor. And just as he holds out his arms for her to dance, like the band changes into something up tempo. And of course, he can't dance fast. So it's really, exactly. It's really like humiliating for him, although he does end up dancing fast.
Yeah. That's the kind of victory that we liked. Like very small victories with a lot of conditions on them and some large comic conceit that makes it a little bit embarrassing and funny.
My guest is Jay Kasdan, and he wrote and directed the new film, The TV Set, which stars David Duchovny as a television writer who's in the process of auditioning and shooting a pilot for a new series that he's proposed. Now, you're speaking to us now from the soundstage of the movie that you're making. And the movie that you're making now is, from what I've read, a satire of music biopics like Walk the Line, the movie about Johnny Cash, and Ray, the movie about Ray Charles. It sounds like a great idea for a film. Why did you want to satirize music biopics?
It's music biopics and also just sort of the biopic great man kind of movies in general. I guess I'm a sucker for those movies, and I go to see all of them, like, the week they come out. And you go, and there's always something, to me, kind of mesmerizing about those movies. A lot of times it's the music, and a lot of times it's, well, almost always there's a, well, really every single time, there's a central performance, whoever's playing the guy, doing sort of an incredible tour de force performance, the role they were born to play. And then there's also a way that these movies start to get sort of similar to each other that I thought was kind of funny, which is that, namely, from humble beginnings, a genius emerges, spends their life wrestling with a childhood trauma, usually the death of a relative, their, you know, struggle that they're working out through their music as they're also breaking musical ground, fighting addiction.
Right.
Marrying, divorcing, fighting another addiction.
Rehab, yeah.
Rising, falling, yeah. Rising, falling again. And I don't know, it was a moment of, it would be funny to make a fake biopic was essentially the idea. And it should be called Walk Hard, The Dewey Cox Story. That was the entire initial idea. I mentioned it to Judd Apatow, who I've worked with a lot and who's a really good friend of mine. I mentioned it to him kind of in passing, and he got excited about it and called me up a couple days later and said, I think we should actually do this. Let's write it together and go make it. And that launched this thing, which has been great fun and fun to do. John C. Reilly is playing the title part. We're about halfway through shooting. But this particular goofy idea has the funny caveat, which is that because it's not a real person and the genres that we're sort of playing with is completely dependent on the original music of the person being depicted, we had to generate a whole canon of his hits. So we've spent like 6 months prior to the beginning of shooting developing, writing, recording, all this original music that John sings, 35 original songs that he's tracked.
What genre are they?
The character starts out kind of, you know, in the... Well, John plays the role from the age of 14 to the age of 80. and he... So he starts in high school, and, you know, it sort of follows him through the 50s where he's kind of a Roy Orbison, Buddy Holly, Waylon Jennings kind of composite, which is a big, that's kind of a wide swath right there. But and then it sort of continues through the 60s, and he goes through sort of a political period, and then sort of a, you know, a psychedelic, you know, playing with orchestras and sounds, and, you know, through the 70s where he has a television variety show and sort of tracks his entire life. So he's a cross-genre hybrid.
Oh, great. Good luck with the movie you're working on now and with the TV set. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for talking to me, Terry. I love your show.
Jake Kasdan wrote and directed the new movie, The TV Set.